All right, welcome to the Sublation Magazine show. Just wanted to start at the top by announcing that we're going to be covering the WPATH leaks. These are newly released internal files from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health that prove that the practice of transgender medicine is neither scientific nor medical. I'm quoting Michael Schellenberger, who reported this on his Substack called Public. And the American Medical Association, the Endocrine Society, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and thousands of doctors worldwide rely on WPATH to set standards of practice. It is considered the leading global authority on gender medicine, but the WPATH files prove that gender medicine is comprised of unregulated and pseudoscientific experiments on children, adolescents, and vulnerable adults, and will go down as one of the worst medical scandals in history. Again, I'm quoting from Michael Schellenberger. We're going to be talking about this leak, what it actually means, giving our own opinions. I'm Douglas Lane, the author of the novel Bash Bash Revolution and the CEO and editor of Sublation Media.
And I'm Ashley Frawley. I'm a sociologist at the University of Kent, author of several books and journal articles, and the COO of Sublation Media.
So in this episode, we're going to provide our own analysis of the WPATH files. Hopefully, Megan Murphy, the founder of Feminist Current, will be joining us. We have an excerpt from an interview with Andrew Doyle that we'll be running. And in the second hour, we'll invite the patrons who have been watching to join a conversation about this topic on our stream for patrons only. And I'm going to run the introduction, the usual intro to Sublation Magazine. We'll see you on the other side.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets such as military bases and chemical plants may be advised to evacuate.
All right. So, Ashley, are we following a very important story, and does this change the entire dynamic and conversation around transgender politics, or are we just being shitty? What do you think?
Well, you'll see in the interview with Andrew Doyle in a moment, toward the end of the stream, Andrew seemed to think that it was should be the most explosive revelation regarding medical malpractice this century. But if you watch GB News, you might get that idea. But if you were to scroll over to, click over to BBC, you wouldn't find anything about it. If you watch mainstream, just the nightly news, nobody was covering it, which is a little bit strange. And of course, if you try to look anything up on it on YouTube, I think we might be the only left-wing channel that's covering this.
Okay, that's interesting. What I have done, I've read the files, and I'm going to describe them briefly. They're a bunch of internal documents and conversations between clinicians, for the most part, and people within the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. And there was a report written by Public summarizing what the documents contain, but I've looked through them myself. And along with like Slack chats and message board chats that are screen captured and a part of the documents, there were some Zoom, there was, I think, one 90-minute Zoom conversation between some clinicians. And I wanted to start off by running a clip from that. So this is a Zoom call between clinicians who are treating patients for transgender, for gender dysphoria. And we're going to see Diane Berg speaking here.
My understanding and what I'm trying to kind of incorporate in my clinical practice is in some ways moving away from what is your identity, and therefore because you have this identity, you're going to want to do these particular medical interventions to change your body, not having it be as identity driven, because I think that's been the historical basis of kind of how things have operated. And instead, regardless of your identity, what do you think about your body and what do you want your body to be able to be and how do you feel in your body and what's going to help you feel better about being in your body and how do we address some of that regardless of what your identity is. And that might mean medical, that might mean lifting weights, that might mean eating better. I mean, there's a whole range, but it just kind of goes shifting your thinking from identity-driven interventions to more, for some people, more body-driven interventions. It is kind of is what I would try to say about that.
So that was Diane Berg. She is an associate professor and licensed psychologist with an emphasis in child and adolescent gender health at the Institute for Sexual and Gender Health. She provides clinical services to adults and adolescents and children who have gender concerns and sexuality concerns. And she describes here how she tries to move away from questions of identity to questions of the body when she's working with her patients. And I think that's noteworthy. And what's noteworthy about it is that it's a way of interpreting gender dysphoria that admits that she doesn't really follow the gender affirming model. So I have no idea how many of her patients end up on hormones or getting surgical procedures, but by emphasizing the patient's body, she's addressing the patient's medical concern, which is dysphoria, but she is also addressing overall concerns about health and discomfort. And so I think that if her approach were to be understood, as I interpret it, this could mean that gender dysphoria would cease to be a culture war issue and could instead be treated as a medical issue. Obviously, the cultural and political questions around civil rights and gender recognition would remain, but those issues would not be the domain of doctors or psychologists. So that the reason why I want to underscore this as a possibility is because if it's true, as Andrew Doyle has said, that this is a big story about a major and pervasive case of malpractice, we should be able to take that up without abandoning our principles around free expression, freedom from discrimination, and so on. But if it is indeed medical malpractice, we can't afford, people on the left can't afford, and people who are concerned about transgender people can't afford to ignore the evidence. So Ashley, what did you?
Yeah, I'm just a bit curious. So what you're trying to say is that if we treat this as a medical issue, then we need to be clear that the medical treatments appear to be doing a great deal of damage.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be honest about that and weigh that up. And I was a bit unclear about what you meant about culture war stuff.
Well, I mean, there are many questions about what it means to be a woman or a man, or what the relationships between men and women should be. There are questions of whether or not the nuclear family is the best model for raising children. There are questions about how to raise children. There are all sorts of cultural differences between people. And the fundamental thing in a modern bourgeois liberal society is that we should all have the same rights as individuals, be free from discrimination, have freedom of expression, the right to organize politically, and so on. And if people want to struggle for an expansion of expression of gender in the public spaces, they should do so on that basis and not on the basis of a medical condition or something that is requiring that we put those regular standards aside. So we have Megan. Megan Murphy here with us.
There we go. We have Megan Murphy is an independent writer and podcaster and the founder of Feminist Current. On her Substack, she describes herself as the most canceled woman in Canada and is now based in Mexico, hopefully hasn't been run out of Canada with pitchforks. She says that she spent most of her life as a socialist and feminist, but appears now to spend most of her time pissing these groups off in various ways. Megan Murphy, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you? Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. I'm not sure if you heard any of what we were discussing there, but Doug sort of put forward the case that people should be free to sort of act as they wish and perform gender roles or not as they wish. But when medicine comes into it, things begin to get complicated. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who's been a lifelong feminist, I'm not a huge fan of these kinds of political ideological labels nowadays, but you know, I've always been supportive of pushing back against gender stereotypes. I mean, in my opinion, I think that we should just stop talking about gender entirely. I know that's unrealistic, but the important thing is biological sex, and this gender identity ideology has posited and then pushed that there's maybe no such thing as biological sex, that biological sex is something that you can change if you so desire, and it's not true. And yeah, I mean, I'm fully supportive of people living their lives in ways that feel authentic to them. And I think that people should be respected. I don't think that we should be pushing these ideologies on kids who don't understand what this means, what the future implications of so-called transitioning means. And it, you know, in general, I feel that the public has been lied to about transgenderism and the practices connected to transgenderism.
So the reason I wanted, the reason I wanted to bring that forward is because I feel as though there are many people on the left who view the transgender issue primarily as an issue of rights and as a struggle for equality and to break free from discrimination, and who then will take that desire to break from discrimination and to make sure everyone has the same rights for self-expression and then insist upon the gender-affirming care model being the only way to adequately do that, or insist upon reifying this notion of gender as a justification for their political and cultural struggle, which I don't think is necessary. Like, you have to abandon that cultural struggle. And I just wanted to point that out at the beginning, because I know we're going to get a lot of flack. And so this is my way of saying, listen, we're not opposing transgender people's right to for self-expression, or be their right to be free from job discrimination or housing discrimination. But when it comes to gender-affirming care, that's a medical model that needs to be looked at on those terms. Would you agree?
I mean, I think part of the, I mean, I agree in some areas, but I think part of the problem is this framing of transgender people as a group of people, as somehow a cohesive, definable group of people that need special rights. Because that's not true. I mean, we don't know who we're talking about here. No longer does transgender even require surgical or hormonal interventions. You know, you don't actually have to transition to anything in order to identify as trans. You can be somebody like me or you, and tomorrow say, I'm trans, I'm a man, I'm a woman, whatever. I mean, none of it is necessary from the get-go. Again, it's like if a man, for example, prefers wearing dresses, then okay, he prefers wearing dresses. That doesn't make him a woman. There's nothing that he can do to make him a woman. So the premise is flawed from the get-go. And then when we start framing this as a question of rights, then we do get into this muddy territory where it's like, maybe you should have the right to transition. Maybe you should have the right as a man to access women's bathrooms. Maybe you should have the right to be transferred to a woman's prison if you're a male criminal. And all that stuff has become really dangerous. And the idea behind transitioning of kids is, I think, in my opinion, twofold. One aspect is to justify and legitimize this concept of the trans adult. You know, if there's a trans adult, then there are trans kids. They've attached themselves to the born this way narrative that was used in gay rights struggles. you know, some kids are just born trans. That's what they say, which is not true. There's no child that's born in a wrong body. There's no boy that's actually a girl. And again, kids don't understand these ideologies. They don't understand these politics. They certainly don't understand their own bodies. They don't understand the implications of these puberty blockers, hormones, surgeries on their future abilities to have intimate relationships and families. The other aspect is that, you know, there's the argument, and you know, it's true in some ways that if a child is put on puberty blockers and hormones before he goes to puberty, then he'll pass better as an adult, or she'll pass better as an adult. This applies to boys, males, more than it does to females. But, you know, it's hard for adult men to appear as women once they've gone through puberty. Once you're an adult man, you have the body of an adult man, and there's not too much that you can do about it. But again, these are not the concerns of kids. They don't understand what it means to pass as a adult trans person. And the health implications are horrific. You know, if you read the WPATH files, many of us who've been following this issue for a long time knew a lot of this stuff. We knew that these puberty blockers and hormones were not reversible, as was claimed. We knew that these surgeries were experimental. We knew that the implications for, you know, a sex life in the future were grim. We know that for women, for example, who want phalloplasties, they're going to suffer a lifetime of pain and complications and surgeries. Often these surgeries are rejected. It's really gruesome stuff. And the fact that people, especially minors who can't really give informed consent, are just being pushed through these processes without a second thought. You know, the clinicians that we see and hear from in the WPATH files are so casual. What do we do when a vagina atrophies? You know, some of these patients have experienced extremely painful sex and bleeding and painful orgasms. It's painful to urinate. And that still doesn't stop them, right?
Yeah. I want to go into them, just all the ways in which the WPATH files reveal the dangers involved in these kinds of procedures, because I think that's very important, and that's the main story here. But just to ask a couple questions about the other part of your answer, do you think that if it were to be the case that people aren't born homosexual, would they no longer require or be, should we no longer provide them with the rights that they might need in order to be free from discrimination so that they can be equal and treated in an equal way to heterosexual people?
I mean, I think that gay people should be treated the same as heterosexual people, regardless of whether they're born that way. You know, well, I don't know if for everybody being
what
gay
about
is
someone who cross-dresses in their private life.
I think
should they be allowed to have a job and be free from job discrimination or housing discrimination?
That's a tough question, because I think that it's one thing to have a private fetish, and for men this is a fetish. There's studies that have been done that have shown that for the younger men who transition, it's tended to be young gay men transitioning, because, you know, maybe they live in homosexual cultures or homophobic cultures, and or they have a family that's homophobic. And they feel like it might be easier if they could live as a straight woman. But the adult men, the middle-aged men who transition, tend to be autogynephiles, which is a sexual fetish. And so, no, I don't think it's an appropriate thing to bring your sexual fetish out into the public or into the workplace. And so framing that, I think, as discrimination is a bit disingenuous. You know, what people do in the privacy of their own home, so long as it's not abusive or harming somebody else, I think, is their business. But I don't support adult men parading their fetishes around and imposing those fetishes on other people. And yeah, I think it's manipulative to frame it as discrimination, which of course many have.
So if a gay man were to dress in a way that might be thought to be obviously gay, I don't know, flowered shirts, maybe wear a skirt, would that be the same as parading their fetish around?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's you're right. Like, I think you're making good points, because where are we drawing the line here? Like, I
just think of, like, in 1901, heterosexuality was described as a paraphilic disorder, because it was someone who was overly overwhelmed by their attraction for the opposite sex. And that was during a time where people, choosing their own lovers and being driven by their sexuality and romantic interests rather than the interests of the community or the families was beginning to really break out. Right. So, and it was thought of as a disorder. So, I mean, I think we should be careful about conflating this issue of medical malpractice with this, our cultural concerns, our questions around sexual morality.
I don't think you can divide these things up, because there is something going on here. Like, one of our commenters said, oh, I think it's insulting that you would say this has anything to do with a sexual fetish. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why people transition. Some of them probably are sexual, certainly are sexual. That's just the case, but not for everybody. And there's also something much deeper going on culturally, in the same way that what was then called multiple personality disorder became went from like a few very rare cases to, I don't know how many, maybe tens of thousands or something like that in the early 1990s. Why? Because it became culturally available as a way of making sense of discontent and in, it seems, particular cases of child abuse. But why? Why did it was, as Ian Hacking writes in Rewriting the Soul, it is a real thing in the sense that people aren't just lying, that they had multiple personalities, but it became a culturally specific form of expressing discontent. And I think there's something going on in our culture regarding an uncertainty around identity and gender norms and who you're supposed to be and growing up and all of this kind of stuff that's being expressed through this particular, very culturally specific means of doing so, through confusion about gender. So I don't think you can disentangle these things. Now, bringing medicine into it makes it a hell of a lot more like, okay, if we were just having a kind of confusion and working something out as a society, it wouldn't be that bad. But bringing medicine into it complicates the situation, because now you are sort of locking in something that is, as I said, culturally specific in ways that we don't really have good surgical means to do.
Go ahead. I want to, after you, Megan, I do want to get another clip in from the WPATH files, because I think it really illustrates the problem of trying to conflate these two things. But go ahead.
I agree with what Ashley's saying, but I think that we're also, in terms of the cultural question and the question of expression, I mean, I think a lot of people, and trans activists in particular, will claim that this is just about people expressing themselves and being who they are. But that's not what we're just talking about. We're talking about men accessing women's spaces and girls' spaces. We're talking about adult men going into girls' change rooms, women's change rooms, women's bathrooms, things like that, under this claim that, this is who they are. And, also, of course, that these are spaces where they're safe and they're no longer safe in the men's spaces. But, it is about imposing this on other people and endangering other people. When we're talking about practices that are putting girls and women in danger, we do have to think beyond just expression. It's one thing to be wanting to wear women's clothes out in public, and it's another to say, because I'm wearing women's clothes out in public, I need access to these spaces.
Right. I do want to point out that the WPATH files don't really resolve the question of who belongs in what bathrooms, but they do really point to some problems of in terms of medical treatment for people who have gender dysphoria. And one aspect of the WPATH reports that's worth underscoring is evidence of some correlation between dissociative identity disorder and gender dysphoria.
I find that very interesting because I have long said that this is a repeat of the multiple personality disorder epidemic of the 80s and 90s. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, as a socialist who's concerned about depoliticization and alienation, and, you know, having read enough theory to see disassociation as kind of endemic to capitalist society, I want to take special note of that correlation. And I'm not sure what to make of it entirely, but it's worth considering. But I also wanted to run this clip from WPATH because it speaks to the way in which gender clinicians and people who are advocates of gender affirming care do the opposite of what maybe we might be risking doing if we're too focused on trying to use WPATH and these leaks to settle the question of bathrooms. Like, because what they're doing is saying, look, this is clearly just a question of rights alone, and any differences that you might apply as you give hormonal therapy between different kinds of patients amount to bigotry. So someone said in the WPATH files that the people who are disassociated or schizophrenic and seeking hormonal therapy to transition should not be considered different than people who are hypogonadic. In other words, they have sex glands that don't produce enough hormones for normal development. So this clinician is conflating a treatment aimed at remedying a biologically based ailment with a psychosocial condition around questions of identity. And I just think that these things should be separated out. I'm real quick, run a clip from WPATH, and then we'll get back into the conversation. Hold on one second. It's this one.
A little bit. I think what comes up for me is helping people to explore socioculturally what it means to be masculine, feminine, male, female, because there's kind of the internal sense of it, and then there's also the way that gets perceived in the world. And it sounds like for some of these folks, like, for whatever reason, it's more about how they're being perceived by others and maybe kind of what others are then attributing to them or assuming about them because they're interpreting them as male, when maybe those aspects of maleness are not what they aspire to or what they want. And so I think it's all about kind of that therapy around what does it mean in our culture to be kind of, what does gender mean in our culture, and how is that going to play out for how you see yourself and how others see you. So it's kind of those deeper conversations.
So I just think it's really fascinating that we're trying to solve these cultural questions around sexuality, sex, and I guess this thing called gender through this in these very concrete ways that have tremendously harmful side effects, when we ought to be working politically to change society so that people are less alienated and can be freer. That's my rhetoric anyway.
It's all just so strange to me because I grew up in the 90s, and in the 90s it was cool to be a tomboy. You know, when I was a kid, I did play with trucks and I didn't like girly things and I hated pink and I didn't want to wear frilly dresses and I didn't want to be a ballerina. And I remember being a kid and having role models that, you know, I didn't feel like a weirdo. I certainly didn't feel, you know, persecuted because I wanted to wear boys' clothes instead of girls' clothes. And I still feel that way. I feel that, you know, I'm living the life of a liberated woman thanks to the work of second wave feminists. I feel like second wave feminism did a lot to say boys and girls can be who they want to be, and that there's nothing wrong with a boy that wants to play with dolls or a boy that wants to wear a dress, and vice versa. There's nothing wrong with a girl who wants to play with trucks or have short hair or rough house or, you know, play sports, of course. You know, these are all really, I think, empowering and liberating ideas. And somehow we've gone backwards, right? Where now we're saying that a boy who likes so-called girl things, who wants to play with dolls, who wants to wear a dress, isn't a boy at all. He's not just a boy who likes these things. He's actually a girl, and he needs to modify his body accordingly. And I think it's a really regressive idea. I also think it's really dangerous. I think as a society, we did get very far in the West, at least, you know, in North America, in terms of accepting kids who are different. That was a really prominent message again during the 90s and the 80s as well. And I, you know, I wish that we could get back to that. And these practices are just so extreme. Again, completely experimental. There's really no long-term studies on what happens to so many of these kids later in life. We can learn a lot from the detransitioners, primarily the girls who get these surgeries or go on these hormones when they're teenagers, and then decide a few years later, maybe when they're 20 or so, that they've made a mistake, but their bodies are changed for life.
Yeah.
I absolutely resonate with what you're saying here, because when I hear people having discussions about gender, it is so alien to me. Like, again, I grew up in the late 80s and 90s when it was like you could do anything. It didn't really matter. Like, just because you were born with certain genitalia, it didn't dictate who you were going to be. And then I hear people talking about how they like, well, I didn't do this and that, so that must mean I knew from a very young age that I was not truly a boy. And like, I think there was a space where girls could be tomboys, but I think it was less acceptable maybe for boys to be effeminate. But, you know, we had just gone through this huge explosion of like celebration of gay rights. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, this very strange, what seemed to me very backward kind of discourse about gender came in through the back door. And I wonder, you know, why did that, like, you know, I've got friends who are gay men who are effeminate, and they're still men. they're doing masculinity like in a different way, quote unquote effeminate, right? Because we have certain traits that we assign to various sexes, but there's nothing necessary about that. And, you know, they're quite happy gay men. And I wonder, I really do wonder, like a friend of mine, he said, well, when I was young, I wanted to be a fairy. That's what he said, I wanted to be a fairy. Like, would we allow a boy to say that now? Would we start to think, oh... So I want, like, do you have any sense of how that happened? How we had such an embrace of like, be who you are and just, it's okay to be gay. And then all of a sudden you have young people saying things like, oh, if I'm not trans, does that mean I'm just a lesbian? Like things like that.
Yeah. It's hard to pinpoint where it came from. I do think that there was a trend in academia that moved from women's studies. When I was in university, there was still women's studies. And, you know, you could study women's history or women in the media or women in politics, women in work. And at some point in the aughts, women's studies started becoming gender studies. And it was this postmodern theory around gender and what does it mean to be a man in society? What does it mean to be a woman in society? You know, primarily, you know, Judith Butler was one of the key philosophers, academics who is working in this realm and who said, you know, we're gender fluid and gender is just a performance, which was twisted into sex is just a performance. You know, maybe we don't know what a woman is. Maybe that doesn't mean anything at all. Maybe if a woman does gender in a different way, she can actually be a man. So there was those ideas. And then, of course, there was this push to normalize transgenderism that was led by these adult men who were autogynephiles. And you know, I'm not applying these labels to these people in a cruel way. If you listen to the stories of these adult men, they'll usually talk about things like being turned on by putting on women's clothes. They'll talk about the influence of pornography in their identities and their desire to wear women's clothes, not just in private, but in public. I think that the push to normalize these practices was attached to these academic theories and attached to these political movements then that, again, talked about, you know, trans rights are human rights. And we need to accept trans people in society. In order to do this, I have to be accepted as a woman, and I have to legally be accepted as a woman, and I have to be accepted into these spaces. And I think that somehow that got melded with this gender theory and this, you know, third wave feminism, which is the version of feminism that appears to me to be more of a backlash to feminism than anything else, in the late 90s, and that we're still experiencing now.
I just want to say something about the autogynephilic story, which is that I think that we should think about that in combination with stories that we hear about how difficult it is for young men and young women to find satisfying relationships or start dating. People are more isolated than they have been in the past. And I know a story of a young man who became decided that he was trans. So now he's a she, I guess. And it was only after that that he managed to find a young woman who believed that she was a he, and they began to date, and now they have worked out of what it would be in another time a perfectly normal, normative, heterosexual relationship, only the genders are reversed. But I think we should recognize that people are just trying to navigate their lives so they can achieve these things that everybody kind of wants, which is to have romantic relationships, sexual relationships, a place in the world, a meaningful work, all those kinds of things. And they're just doing it in this climate where there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of social isolation and alienation. And the last thing we need is to be so wedded to an ideology that we're going to push these kids to have these permanent changes made to their body. But we also don't need to vilify them or castigate them for some of these choices that they're making that aren't necessarily permanent, like whether or not they want to cross dress or call themselves by a woman's name or what have you. That it's not so threatening, really. I mean, there are some times when it is, but overall, I think we should try to see each other as all struggling with the same problems and just trying different ways to solve it.
I think one of the things that we need to remember is, like, first of all, what it was like to be a kid and what it was like to go through puberty. You know, I think that I'll speak for girls because I went through puberty as a girl. You know, you're going to feel confused and unhappy and uncomfortable with your body. You're going to feel really insecure. Teenagers in general are struggling with their identities, struggling to fit in, struggling to figure out who they are, and sort of trying on different personas in a lot of ways. You know, when I was a teenager, it was like you were trying on different categories, but they weren't permanent categories, and they weren't, you know, it wasn't a surgery. It wasn't like a medical intervention. They were it was clothing or music or makeup or something like that. And, you know, I wish that we could go back to that, because I feel that those were more open-minded times. And it's so strange to me that adults have forgotten. It seems that all of these adults who are pushing or going along with these trans narratives and this, if you're born trans, you need to have these medical interventions, otherwise you'll be miserable as an adult, or you can't be who you really are. And it's like they've all forgotten what it's like to be a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old and to have all these crazy things happening to your body. And, you know, your brain is going crazy at the same time. There's all these new hormones that you're dealing with. And you're generally insecure. You're a teenager. You don't really know who you are, and you don't know how to be yourself, really. You're just figuring that out. And these interventions are it's just so, again, minors don't understand what they're getting into. And I think it's so wrong to be putting this on them or to be allowing them to do this. You know, when you're an adult, you have the choice to do what you want. If you want to take hormones, if you want to get cosmetic surgeries, okay. I think the adults aren't being properly informed either, to be honest, about these trans surgeries. I think the adults are not fully informed that these surgeries can be really complicated and that they might have to have several surgeries and that they might not work and that their sexual organs might not work and they might not be able to orgasm and so on and so forth, that these hormones increase the risk of cancer and have other health implications. But kids really don't understand that.
Right. I mean, that's in the WPATH files that's one of the major topics of conversation in that Zoom conversation that got released, which is all these clinicians discussing how difficult it is to truly get informed consent. From teenagers, certainly, like they almost, you know, one guy says they think they're going to live forever. They don't listen. They don't really think about what sterility might mean because they can't imagine a future where they might want kids and things like that. But even parents and adults have difficulty taking up the full range of the severe side effects that might be a consequence of hormonal therapies, for instance. I have a clip about detransitioners that we
can I just say before you run that clip, mm-hmm. One of our commenters said, oh well, what if teens want to, right? What if they want to do this? Isn't it, in a free society, we encourage people to take up different kinds of options? I think you have to also understand like how powerful a narrative this has become, and I think we need to have an open conversation and allow open conversations about the fact that, you know, identity is, you know, it's not like you look inside yourself and you find this fixed identity you were born with. And I know that, like, I think we have far too much of a static and rigid understanding of our psychology. And that part of the reason is because people are looking for something firm. You know, you come of age and there's no pathway that's set for you anymore. You know, if you were born 1,000 years ago, you would have known exactly what it meant to be a man or a woman because you would just be living your parents' lives. And your children would be living your life. You know, our identities were so rigid that you could have a surname that, like Baker, because it reflected that you came from a long line of bakers, right? And now it's like, wow, what am I going to be? Who am I going to be? So people are looking for something solid, but there's nothing in the outside world that's solid. So they look inside themselves. This is a terrible mistake because yourself is incredibly fluid. And I know people make claims about gender fluidity and all this sort of stuff, but it's actually looking for a kind of rigidity, something like I want to find out who I am. They think it's like discovering an actual identity. And that's a story we're kind of giving them. And I absolutely agree with you, Megan, that we're doing an incredible disservice to people. Yes, try on different identities. Yeah, like explore what you like and what you dislike and like something now, and it's okay if you don't like it 5 years from now. That's cool, right? But this idea that it has to be set in stone, it has to be who you are, you have to be born this way, sets people on this kind of path that makes it very difficult to kind of dissuade people from if it's going to cause problems medically or whatever. Yeah, experiment with your identity. That's great. The problem is that we are treating this as though it's not an experiment. It is a discovery of who you truly are. It's giving people a firm ground, apparently giving people a firm ground that doesn't actually exist.
You know, someone asked, the start of this with this was that someone asked, what about teenagers who really want to do this? And the answer sometimes is no. Teenagers get told no because they're not adults. They don't have the full rights of adults. They might want to do things like get a tattoo or stay over at their boyfriend's house when they're 13 or a variety of other things that parents and authorities say no to, and doctors should say no more to patients who want to have medical procedures that they don't fully understand, and that when there are less invasive ways to address their dysphoria or their discomfort.
I mean, that is a whole other part of this as well, is that there's a crisis of authority in society. There's a crisis of adult authority as well. And sort of being the idea that you can say as a parent, you have to say no. Everyone's going to look at you like you're a fascist, right? Like that's like the next frontier is like children's rights and freedom of children. It's ludicrous. But, you know, Hannah Arendt said that the crisis of authority had reached its apex when we started to doubt the authority of adults over children. Just like it had always been taken for granted that as, you know, as an adult, you have to say no, you have to put up boundaries, you have a responsibility to the next generation to socialize them, to keep them safe. And now we're questioning even that. And that's a very strange space to be in when there isn't any authority in the adult world. And that also makes it hard to grow up because you're not going into a higher status where you will have authority, you're losing it because children are the future. Now you're not, you're an adult, you're responsible for the problems of the world.
We're in this space where children are treated as though they have the ability to direct politics, for example. I don't know that there's ever been any other point in history where we're telling children that they get to make their own decisions. You want to eat candy for breakfast? Go ahead. It's your choice. You know best. I mean, what would you say to your kid if he or she announced that they wanted to chop off their arm? You would say no.
I'd take them to a therapist and hope that they weren't an arm chopping off affirming
affirmative therapist.
Exactly. It's strange that this is being permitted and allowed as something different.
I want to highlight just exactly what some of the side effects are from some of these treatments. Again, you know, as I said at the beginning, this doesn't mean that the different forms of expression, in my opinion, are verboten or that there's anything, not that there's anything wrong with that, as Seinfeld would say, but when it comes to these treatments, they really need to be taken, the side effects need to be taken very seriously. In trans men, hormonal treatment can lead to what's called vaginal atrophy. In trans women, hormonal treatment can lead to permanent diminishment of the size of the penis. Intercourse is often painful for both trans men and trans women. The WPATH files relate incidents where trans women who are on estrogen experience significant pain during erections. A trans woman who has been surgically altered and given a neo vagina must use a dilator to ensure the orifice doesn't close and seal. Complications after such a procedure are not rare. And one trans woman, I believe it was a trans woman, no, it was a trans man or trans boy. The WPATH files include a report on a patient who reported feeling brainwashed into transition. This was a 17-year-old girl who was on testosterone and resented the permanent changes to her body that resulted from going on testosterone at the age of 15. I'm going to run a clip on
it. And when you deny any aspect of it, you are limiting yourself to a certain extent. You're cutting off parts of yourself if you pretend it doesn't exist. And clinically, we've been told, trans people have been told historically, oh no, don't talk about that. So it's really, really something that our professions need to combat. Thank you, Diane. That's good.
All right, so I'm going to end with a question. I'm going to stop my screen share here. And I'm going to bring this up to my panelists really quickly. If anybody has any closing thoughts, one question that we didn't get to was steps to support folks who have regret or interventions. I think it's such a new area. We don't have data on it, to my knowledge, but it looks like a lot of folks are looking for support. And I would say we need to normalize their exploration just as we would normalize people considering transitioning to a gender different than what they're assigned at birth, and to get them supports to do that. And again, try not to other people in the process, not to marginalize or put down other people.
So I think that's a big revelation. These clinicians and the people who are the professionals of addressing transgender health don't have data on the level of regret and detransitioning. They don't really have good data on that. And that's an admission from WPATH itself. I think that those kinds of details, the fact that there are, that it's very difficult to get informed consent, that the side effects from these procedures are severe at times, and there are some procedures that almost always come along with major side effects, like getting a neovagina, and the fact that there's not a good tracking system. There's not been very good studies to indicate what the level of detransitioning is, and how much regret is out there after the fact. All of these, I think, point to the fact that we have to readdress and rethink how we treat and how we encourage young people, especially, but all sorts of different people from undergoing these kinds of procedures.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, there's never a case where this is necessary or helpful. I think that when kids, when youth and teens are exploring identities and learning about themselves and learning about, you know, who they are, that shouldn't require surgical intervention ever or medical intervention ever. These are healthy kids that we're talking about with healthy bodies. You know, what are they being treated for? Having feelings, you know, having wondering if they like wearing pants or dresses. They should be free to explore these things. And I think that these interventions are, you know, not only unnecessary, but as we can see through the WPATH files, and as I think that, again, many of us know who've been following this for a long time, who've listened to detransitioners, who understand the long-term implications of these medications and surgeries, that they're really, really harmful and really destructive, and they're ruining kids' lives. You know, they're not, these treatments are not making kids' lives better. They're making kids' lives worse. You know, they become adults who can't form normal intimate relationships, who can't enjoy sex, who can't have families, who can't reproduce. You know, there's no turning back so many of these treatments.
Yeah. Ashley, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, besides the fact that in addition to everything we've just said, there also isn't a very good definition of what gender even is. So I had just talked, we had just talked about stereotypes and so on, but you know, people will swear, advocates will swear up and down that it's got nothing to do with gendered stereotypes, that you can be a woman, you know, dressed in jeans, doing gardening, as a guest on Andrew Doyle's Free Speech Nation said on Sunday, and that gender is a kind of essence. I wonder, I'd like to kind of steel man that argument if possible. Maybe the commenters, I see that there's one commenter who thinks we're off our rockers here. Who is it? Sam Badger. Maybe you could steel man that for me. What is a gendered essence? And Megan, have you heard any argument along those lines that you actually do find convincing? Has there ever been an argument around gender and gender transition that you think actually is really strong?
No, because I think that we're taught, you know, the language around transgenderism is often, I feel like a woman, or I don't feel like a woman, you know. So from a man who's saying, you know, I feel like I'm a woman on the inside. And as a woman, I don't know what it feels like to feel like a woman on the inside. I don't believe that I have a gendered essence. I've never felt particularly feminine. You know, there's things that I like, you know, in terms of clothing, or there's behaviors that I have that I think could be called masculine behaviors. I don't really care either way. I don't really care if the things I like are masculine or feminine, or if my personality reads as masculine or feminine. I am who I am. I'm fine with that. And that's what I want for everyone else. You know, it doesn't matter. I'm not trying to be rude, but I don't really care if you feel masculine or feminine. Feel however you want to feel. Your body is your body, and sometimes we're not happy with our body. And I do understand that there's some people out there who might have severe distress around their sex body parts. But I don't think that it's important or even like a coherent concept to have our bodies match how we feel on the inside. I can't even imagine what that would mean.
Well, I would like to be like trans large breasted. Can somebody help me out with that?
That can be accomplished. I identify there as are procedures thinner. For that. You can right? have things in, put into your body that will give you exactly that. If there's some side effects you should be aware of.
That's actually part of the reason why I have not aligned my body with my internal sense of
on that point, and we have this Andrew Doyle clip to run, so we should run it. But I would just want to say, like, to say that this is never the most invasive techniques are never justified is I don't feel qualified to say that even after reading about all the side effects in the WPATH files. But what we can certainly say is that the gender affirming model, where that's the first thing that's gone to for these people, that when they come in, they get kind of fast tracked onto at least hormonal, at least social transition, which then there are some studies that show that leads to hormonal therapies or puberty blockers or something else. That needs to be questioned for sure. I mean, that has to be put aside. Whether or not it might be medically necessary for someone with a severe gender dysphoria to undergo some form of medical or surgical intervention, in order to avoid a true crisis, I'm not qualified to say that. I think that there are people who would argue that it is sometimes necessary, and I would just want to hear from them before I would even want to voice an opinion about whether it's ever necessary. But certainly we can say for sure that it's way over, it's being affirmed as the first choice, and it ought not to be.
Yeah.
I suppose I just wonder what we would say, and this is a thing, and I can't remember the term for it, but there are people who exist who are obsessed with removing limbs, for example. You know, they feel very, very strongly that they need to cut off an arm or cut off a leg or something like that. And I wonder what we would say to those people. Would we treat that as a medically necessary surgery or treatment or process to go through because this person feels so distressed by the presence of their arm?
WPATH would say, yeah, we should take those things seriously. They've actually written about that's in the WPATH files. There's some discussion of that. And there are a number of things that they were planning on or talking about doing that would be legitimate identities, like being a eunuch, or something called a null. I mean, obviously, the brakes need to be put on here when it comes to medical interventions. We need to be serious about side effects and serious about Hippocratic Oath of not doing harm, and we need to make sure we get informed consent from people and not just run them through this machine. But at the same time, I don't want to revert to some sort of sexual puritanism or paranoia about people who have different forms of expression either. And I see like the danger is in both directions. Unfortunately, we don't have set norms in our modern society. We don't have traditional ways of life anymore, so these are just problems we're gonna have to deal with, I think. But I talked a lot. I've been very masculine.
Your expression matches your outside body.
All right. Thank you so much, Megan. Is there anything that you wanted to add before we let you go? You've been really brilliant, and thank you for giving so much time to us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you guys having this conversation. I think it's really important. I mean, I've been so distressed about this situation for so many years, and I'm so glad that this conversation is finally opening up in the mainstream and in the public. I know, a lot of women and feminists were treated as insane and hyperbolic when they first started talking about these things, even just 5 years ago, but certainly 10 years ago. I'm so distressed and feel so much empathy and sympathy for these kids who are going through these really normal, regular human experiences that are being medicalized and who are going to suffer the consequences for adult decisions. And I do hope that people take the WPATH files seriously. I hope that government bodies will pay attention. I hope that medical institutions will pay attention. I hope that the mainstream media will pay attention, because this is really serious. And it is, I, you know, if we didn't know before, we know now that there's a great deal of harm that comes from treating kids to these kinds of procedures.
Yep. So we
thank
run
you
the
so much for joining us. And
yeah, thank you.
And thank you so much. And our next guest actually did a 2-hour special on this. One of the very few media organizations that is really devoted a lot of time to this, for better or for worse, depending on what your opinion of them is GB News. And you can go and have a look at Free Speech Nation on the GB News YouTube channel. But I spoke with Andrew Doyle about an hour before we began the stream, as he was doing Comedy Unleashed and wasn't able to come on live. And here's what he had to say. So you did a 2-hour special, is that right? Was it 2 hours on Sunday? I've watched it twice now. I thought it was really excellent. And I wondered, what was the reaction to that? So you talked about the WPATH files. That's what we're talking about on Sublation Media today. But I wondered, what was the reaction? Was it mainly positive, negative, indifferent?
I mean, it's overwhelmingly positive. I mean, I was quite surprised. There's been one or two gripes from people who are trans activists in public life who are very prominent. One of them was complaining online, one who we'd actually invited, of course. I mean, the key thing about the show was that I wanted to ensure that we heard all sides of the story. I invited 33 members of WPATH. So we're talking those medical practitioners who subscribe to the notion of gender affirming care. 33 of them were invited. They all either declined or just ignored the message. I invited Stonewall. I invited Gendered Intelligence. I invited Mermaids. So by far, by some way, the numbers of people in the professional sphere who support gender affirming care were invited in numbers that by far outweigh those who don't. In other words, had everyone agreed to appear in the show who was invited, it would have been far more swayed the other way. But of course, a lot of the activists don't believe in debate. They don't believe in discussion. That's how we got where we are. That's why the medical profession is now so captured. And that's why we're performing widespread medical experiments on children without very much scrutiny.
Can you tell me a little bit about this leak? What exactly happened?
So the WPATH files are a report written by journalist Mia Hughes based on leaked internal messages from an internal chat system at WPATH. WPATH is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. It's the leading global body for when it comes to that supports gender affirming care. It has massive, massive influence. If you go to the website of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, there's a direct link to WPATH standards of care. If you do the same at the General Medical Council, you go straight there. The NHS has openly admitted in the past that it takes its lead from WPATH standards of care. Although I notice over the last few days since the leak, the NHS has been desperately trying to distance itself from WPATH. But all of these activists have incredible reach. The definition of gender identity on the website of WPATH is almost identical to that on Stonewall, and again, almost identical to the website of the NHS. So you can see that the entire medical establishment is moving in lockstep. Now, what these leaked recordings, there's some video recordings of sort of conferences, Zoom conferences, there's also predominantly messages from the chat system. What they show, without a doubt, is that an awful lot of clinicians and individuals who are practicing pediatric gender medicine, as they call it, are aware that their patients cannot provide informed consent. They are fully aware of it. They know that the parents don't understand it either. One of the doctors is heard saying, well, you know, I'm trying to explain this stuff to someone who hasn't even got biology at high school yet. They also are aware that that overwhelmingly these people are suffering from other mental illness, mental illnesses, comorbidities. That many of them will be same-sex attracted and will be mistaking their homosexual orientation for gender confusion. But none of this seems to bother any of them. And they persist with this because they are driven by ideology, not by science. This is pseudoscience. The entire idea is based on the notion that there is such a thing as gender identity, and that in order to better align our bodies with that innate essence, we should be performing surgery on individuals. Really, this is a psychiatric problem. Really, this is a matter for a psychotherapeutic evaluation. But to do so, any doctor that does so, and we know this because doctors have blown the whistle on this and have also expressed concerns that if they do take that route, they are accused of practicing trans conversion therapy. In other words, we are taking the notion that everyone has a fixed gender identity and that anyone who tries to discuss with a child or someone who's vulnerable and says, well, why might you be feeling this way? That they are effectively the equivalent of the doctors of the 60s and 70s who used to wire up gay people to electrodes. And this confusion is what is the reason why the current Conservative government's official policy is that they want to ban trans conversion therapy. Labour, Keir Starmer says they're going to do exactly the same. None of them know what they are talking about. What they are doing is institutionalizing a new form of gay conversion therapy. That's what has happened. I mean, the book by Hannah Barnes called Time to Think revealed that between 80 and 90% of adolescents who were referred to the Tavistock Pediatric Gender Clinic in London, NHS clinic, were same-sex attracted. In other words, the vast majority of these of the young people who have been put on puberty blockers on the NHS, which always leads to cross-sex hormones in virtually all cases, that they are effectively medicalizing gay children. So we have gay conversion therapy practiced in plain sight by our National Health Service. This is shocking. So when we talk about WPATH, it's very easy to think, well, this is just an American thing. You know, it's an American institution from 1979. It's gained immense power, but it's not just American because it has influence throughout the world. I would also just like to point out that NHS Scotland uploaded in 2022, uploaded the draft version of WPATH's Standards of Care, which was version 8 of the Standards of Care, which contained a chapter on eunuch identities. And there's a number of pages. I've read it. The upshot is that medical practice, the recommendations, the official recommendations from WPATH, bear in mind, the leading authority on this in the medical sphere, they're saying that medical practitioners ought to be facilitating the castration of patients who feel that they have an innate eunuch identity. And that was uploaded by the NHS. Now, they did apologize for it, but if that doesn't discredit this organization, I don't know what does. What's especially disturbing about WPATH is if you look on their website, their list of members, they're all medically qualified. This is something, this is an ideology that has infected this world. But sometimes on these forums, it's just activists who aren't medically qualified making bold statements. When doctors come in and say, look, I'm concerned, I've got this patient who's suffering from schizophrenia or dissociative identity disorder or has, you know, schizoid typical traits or whatever it might be. And they say, and they're saying they want to have surgery. They want to be castrated. They want, you know, and the activists are saying, yeah, you should do it. Just do it. And medical experts are getting advice from people who know nothing about the subject. This is, I think, the most shocking thing. You know, the practice itself, but you know, butchery on the NHS is a shocking thing anyway. The idea of experimental medicine on children. When you're talking about scandals, it's on a level of the lobotomy scandal or the ovarectomy scandal, where women in the 17th century, women's ovaries were removed because they felt that it cured hysteria. I don't see the difference here. We have doctors here saying, we think we can align your body with your gender identity, therefore we will perform surgery on you. A gender identity doesn't exist. It's a religious belief. It would be like modifying your body on the basis of a soul. That's what I think is completely shocking about this. The idea, we've become very arrogant, I think, the idea that we've made all this technological progress and therefore those who know what they're talking about, the experts, can't make mistakes. Let's not forget, though, that in the lobotomy scandal, it was the New York Times saying we must persist with this. This is fantastic. It was doctors. It was the top medical elites saying this is important. We need to carry on causing brain damage and killing people for their own good. And it was the families, it was the ordinary people who had to stand up and push back against this. And that's how it ended.
Would you say that there's never any good reason to medically transition?
Well, I'm a liberal and my belief is you should be able to do whatever you want with your body, you know, and I think in the case of your friend, if that is what was required, then in terms of personal psychological happiness or well-being, what's it got to do with me? It's got nothing to do with me. I mean, my issue is when we're talking about children. These people cannot possibly consent. These people don't know what the ramifications are. I also think vulnerable adults are caught up in this as well. I mean, I was someone I know told me a horrible story about, you know, being at the hospital bed next to a young man, 19 years old, obviously gay man, who had been convinced by the medical establishment he was trapped in the wrong body. In other words, he needed to be heterosexualized, which is really what a lot of this is about. This is what the mullahs in Tehran do, is that Iran will pay, the regime will pay for a sex change operation to heterosexualize you, to fix your homosexuality. Now, as it goes to adults, well, you know, I feel that I should be able to do whatever I want with my body. But if I went to a doctor and said, I want you to castrate me, I want you to cut off my arms, I want you to remove my tongue, because I cannot be happy unless you do. I think it would be unethical for that doctor to go along with that. So I think there's a bigger question of this about what do we tolerate here? You know, what someone should do in that situation is refer me to psychiatric evaluation, get me some help. That's not what's happening. So I think you have to balance this point. You have to say, look, as a liberal, we believe that anyone should be able to do whatever they want as soon as it encroaches on someone else's rights, then that's the red line, right? But we also have to uphold medical ethics, and we should not be putting doctors in a position where they are having to green light this unethical practice. They did declare the Hippocratic Oath, which is first do no harm. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, that all people who transition are fetishists, far from it. There have been people who, for whatever reason, must present or must go through this horrible, painful, expensive surgical procedure to attain any kind of comfort in life. I have nothing but sympathy for those people. But my problem is that when those people then try to convince themselves that this is evidence that there is a gender identity and that many, many children must also therefore suffer from this same condition, and therefore try to normalize that through medical practice, that's where it gets very, very dangerous. That is where you do cross that red line of your rights encroaching on other people. In the prison system at the moment, among trans-identified prisoners, there is a much higher proportion of those who are incarcerated for sexual predation and sexual assault. Much higher, considerably higher. Now, what that means is one of two things. Either it means that trans people are inherently have a greater propensity to commit sexual assault, which I don't believe. Or it means that male sexual predators are exploiting self-identification in order to commit their crimes. Far more likely. So therefore, the stats of the inmates in prisons in the UK proves that self-identification is being exploited by predators. No one was ever saying that trans people are inherently predatory. What they're saying is men with a desire to commit acts of rape and sexual assault will go to absolutely any lengths to do that.
I know that I've only got you very briefly, but I just had one more question. Do you think this is going to change anyone's mind? Do you think that this marks a turning point in the whole debate?
It should do, but it won't. And I think the reason it won't is that look at the statement put out by WPATH. The statement from the president of WPATH, Marcy Bowers. And the statement said, anyone who criticizes us is like a flat earther. Now, that is obviously tactical. It is projection. You know, this is a body that is pursuing pseudoscience and is therefore going to accuse its critics of being pseudoscientific as a means of self-defense. I mean, that's what teenagers do. Everyone knows about this tactic. But that's not a statement that should be coming up from a medical professional, the president of a leading medical board. That should not be happening in a sane world. So, no, the medical establishment is too far captured. So I don't know how you deal with that other than governments making it illegal to transition minors, which is obviously what should happen. But there is so much misunderstanding, and lobby groups like Stonewall have far too much power within the UK government for that to happen. As I say, this isn't a left-right issue. Both left and right parties in this country are on board with this terrible thing. They don't understand it. They have no understanding. Will they watch the show I just did where I'm interviewing the experts who do understand it? Probably not. They should, and they should read the WPATH files, and they should get some sense of what's actually going on, and they should stop promoting this dangerous, harmful ideology at the expense of our youngest citizens. I mean, but they won't. Also, of course, we have a problem with the media. The media won't report on this. I mean, there was an article in, weirdly, The Guardian. They've done an article, but that's because it was written by Hannah Barnes, who has done sterling work in this area before. I'm sure the editors probably weren't too happy about it. Janice Turner's written an article in The Times, had an article in The Mail, The Telegraph. Okay, so you've got a spattering of, there's nothing in all the other newspapers. There's nothing on broadcast news at all. GB News is the only channel that has covered this, and we've covered it extensively. The BBC, you go on the BBC News website, search WPATH files, nothing. It's been over a week since this broke. Biggest medical scandal of the century, if not all time. And the BBC are posting articles about a cat in Essex getting a statue put up to it. This is what we're talking about. Because the BBC has a body inside of it, has an LGBT plus group that vetoes stories that they think are offensive. This is not how the national broadcaster should be behaving. It's an absolute scandal. I've written to the BBC to ask why they're doing this. I don't expect a response. Now, it might be that they're preparing an incredible expose. They're going to do that. At the moment, they're delaying because they've got loads of research to do. They've got, well, maybe a statement or something would be good, because now, as it stands, I now don't trust the state broadcaster. And this is the first time this has happened to me. I know that they've been caught in lies before. They've made mistakes before. And I always knew that they had a problem with this ideologically. I always knew that. You know, I'm fully aware that when I'm on the news quiz, I'm a diversity hire, right? I'm aware of this, right? But this in particular, the medicalization of children on a grand global scale, and you're not going to cover it, that then becomes sinister, I think.
Doug, you have muted yourself. Rookie mistake.
Yeah, sorry. We have gone over time. We're going to be jumping right into the stream in about 5 to 10 minutes on our Patreon. People can join us, the first 7 or 8 people who find the link in the Patreon post can join us to discuss this further. I feel a little nervous. It's a controversial topic. I feel like it's easy to step wrong.
I no longer feel nervous about it. I used to, and then I realized that was, I have no real instinct for self-preservation, but apparently I did. And it was shameful. It was shameful.
I'm not talking about self-preservation at all here. I'm talking about making sure that we don't become the conservatives that we want to struggle against. I just want to make sure we can keep in mind that cross-dressing isn't a crime, that people who have different gender identities are not criminals either, and that we are all in this struggle together. And that's basically all. That's where I don't want to go wrong.
Yeah, I think that's giving a little too much. But I'm not saying that anybody's criminal. I'm just saying, like, that's the wrong question. All right, so you guys all come on. Come on. Right. Show us why we're wrong. Let's steel man this argument, okay? We've heard overwhelmingly the side that says the WPATH files show that there's something deeply wrong with the gender, how we're approaching gender in society. And I want to hear from you if you agree, if you disagree. So come and join us. Link below.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets such as